Hello everyone, welcome to the Oxford Martin School. My name's Charles Godfrey, I'm the director. And it's my great pleasure to welcome two people who will be talking this evening, Claire Craig. Claire is currently the provost of the Queen's College, but had a very distinguished career at the Royal Society and in government. And Sarah Dillon, Professor of Literature and the Public Humanities at the University of Cambridge. And they'll be talking about narrative evidence and public reasoning. And that's also the subject of a book that they have written recently, and we'll have flyers outside if anyone is interested in that. Just before I invite them onto the stage, this talk is also being live streamed and recorded. And if you're watching online, and I know we've got a big online audience, on Crowdcast, you can ask a question, and you'll see that, I think, at the bottom of your screens. And what's more, you can also vote on other people's questions, and that will be very helpful for me when we come to the public discussion, and we'll be taking comments from both within the hall and virtually. So with no further ado, Claire and Sarah.
Thank you very much, Charles, and it's wonderful to be here. So we're going to do a brief double act to introduce the ideas of the book and then very much enjoy discussion with you. And we start from the presumption that public reasoning requires narrative evidence, and that a pandemic isn't only an epidemiological problem, that climate change is not just a matter of physics, and that the need to use all forms of evidence to be able to distinguish news from fake news, to find new ways to act well in the face of highly uncertain futures, is more urgent now than it ever has been. Of course, all of us know at some level that narratives matter, but particularly in the context of the use of research-based evidence, policymakers and experts actually rarely ask exactly how or why or what to do about it. And that's partly because incorporating narrative evidence robustly is actually not routinely straightforward. A powerful narrative in full flow, whether it's associated with a computational model or with a novel, is seductive, it's charismatic, it's unruly, it's dangerous, if you like. People can place too much confidence in them. Narratives badged as fiction can confusingly hold truths, and narratives badged as truthful may in fact be fiction or downright wrong. There's also a lot of literature and discussion on how to tell narratives, but much less on how to listen to them. And that's where we want to make things different. So we argue, therefore, that public reasoning needs to start taking stories more seriously, that there are robust ways to do this, that including evidence from stories will actually broaden the evidence base, which is a good thing in itself, but it will also, done well, strengthen the use and creation of other forms of evidence, including scientific evidence, even though some may fear that. And as you can tell from what I've just done, we're using the terms story and narrative interchangeably. And in both cases, take that to mean an internally consistent causal account of some system with agents in it. Story is a more provocative term, partly because it's so often used to convey distrust or to trivialize something. But whether it's called a narrative or a story, what's at stake is a thing that is about a form of sense-making in the face of complexity and uncertainty. So we define story listening, which is, we think, a new word, as the theory and practice of gathering narrative evidence in the context of public reasoning, and always as part of a pluralistic evidence base. And what we're trying to do here is to create the conditions under which the task of critical listening to stories is easier, is expected, becomes endemic. And to do that by providing a tool which enables those who study stories and those who might want to get the evidential value from them to have more of a common language and to get that value without the kind of plunge to a post-truth free-for-all or any weakening of the credibility of other forms of evidence. And that framework rests on the definition of four functions of stories, which Sarah will introduce in a moment. But as we go through, please remember these things on the right here. This is about listening, not about telling. It's about cognitive value in stories. It's not about how they make you feel. And it's about collective knowledge and actions, not just whether reading one particular story or report changes one individual's mind on an issue. So Sarah, the four functions.
Brilliant. Thanks, Claire. Hello, everyone. How lovely to be doing things in person again. It's wonderful. So I've got the unenviable job of trying to do the bulk of the book in about 5 minutes. So here goes. So as Claire said, the story listening framework rests on a definition of four functions of stories. And when we decided to write the book and we wanted to make a case of the cognitive value of stories, we realized we needed a really rigorous grounding or foundation in the kinds of functions that they serve. So this is based on a synthesis and a rigorous literature review across humanities and social science disciplines and their theories of the functions of stories. So the first one is points of view. So story listening provides new points of view to inform the framing of the target system and of policy debates. So this is not about politics or stakeholder consultation or deliberative democracy, although it links with all of these. It's saying that the policy and the public framing determines what is taken to be the target system, what's taken to be the part of the world that matters to a particular issue, and that it determines what forms of evidence are expected to be called upon. It also determines what stories are considered most relevant, and they, in a kind of feedback loop, then influence the framing. So to take one example from one of the case studies in the book, which is artificial intelligence, if we took narrative evidence, for instance, from the many stories that there are about alien intelligences, this could convey something of the breadth of ways in which intelligence might be redefined in light of new AI technologies. And it could help reframe debate around the societal benefits and harms of distributed automated systems, rather than, for instance, focusing on the potential benefits or harms of humanoid entities that might be much more charismatic, like the Terminator, but which are possibly much less useful in framing public reasoning about AI. The second function is that stories create and consolidate collective identities. So story listening, we claim, offers new ways to explore what those collective identities are and what they mean. And this can be done in a number of ways. So sociologically gathered narrative evidence about story imbibing, that's the word we use to mean the taking in of stories in different mediums. So reading doesn't work if you're watching films, and viewing doesn't work if you're engaging with literature. So story imbibing is the word that we use. So if we gathered narrative evidence about collective story imbibing and story sharing amongst different groups, this could enhance our understanding of how those groups are constituted and how they behave or how they might behave. And that could be the collective characteristics of AI researchers, which is something I've done individual research on, or how various publics might behave during a pandemic, or when they're engaging other kinds of political activity, for instance, climate activism. And story content matters here as well. So a novel such as Flight Behavior by Barbara Kingsolver, which some of you may have read, it's set in rural Tennessee, actually prompts really interesting questions about the definition and direction of collective agency in the face of climate change. Questions that could, and explorations that could complement more orthodox notions of how we might incorporate group identities into public reasoning. And very recently, the British Academy produced a report in May this year, which takes several disciplinary approaches to defining and exploring collective identities that link to people's behaviours with response to vaccination. And story listening, for instance, could have made a very valuable contribution to that kind of interdisciplinary exercise. The third function is models and modelling. So stories concern the way that public reasoning, like life, rests on implicit models of target systems. So all models are fictitious, even scientific ones, in the sense that to be useful, they have to be abstract, abstractions of the target system, not direct representations of it. There's a famous Borges short story, some of you may know, where they decide to create a model that's a map of the world, and then it becomes so big that it actually covers the world. So it's a kind of cautionary tale about the fact that the map is not the territory. As Mary Morgan and other philosophers of science have explored in depth, stories play a part in the creation and use of non-narrative models. There's also, if you look at the work of Lloyd and Shepard, which we've put up there, storyline approaches to computational modeling of extreme weather events. And stories act as part of scientific models, shaping outcomes in areas such as climate change, but also economics and epidemiology. But one of the perhaps more radical claims in the book is that stories also function as narrative models in their own right. So one of the examples we give is Jane Austen. If you look at her novels and you think of them as narrative models, they can provide information about the target system of middle-class social life in the early 19th century, but of course they also miss some things out from that target system, for instance, colonialism. And in a more contemporary example, Kim Stanley Robinson's novel Aurora is a really interesting narrative model of plausible social and behavioral conditions for a zero waste world. Not just how to balance material cycles, but what kinds of governance and skills we might need in that world. And since we wrote about Kim's work in the book, it was interesting to see him speaking at COP26 in Glasgow. Stories may be the only way, in fact, we claim, of collectively thinking through the potential behaviours of complex systems in some cases. And as always with us, it's both and. A story doesn't provide scientific knowledge, but narrative evidence can enable what we call surrogative reasoning. So it's the reasoning you're able to perform on the basis of a model about things about which there might be no scientific knowledge, or an alternative approach to and perspective on things that can also be known through scientific means. And then the final function before I hand back to Claire is that story listening enables new forms of rigorous anticipation. If you look back at the 1990s, for instance, you can trace a whole range of novels, for instance, by Don DeLillo, which provided narrative evidence that anticipated the financial fragility that only became manifest a decade later. Or Robert Shiller's recent book includes stories as functional elements of anticipation of market behaviours. Or we went back to the mid-20th century, Neville Shute's On the Beach, alongside Herman Kahn's quantitative modelling of death rates, could be understood to be attempting narrative futures models of the consequences of nuclear war that informed policy in the 1960s. So to wrap up the four functions, then a thread of the four functions is how the most charismatic stories can draw attention to themselves and away from the spaces around them. So this is a kind of cautionary element. Stories about humanoid robots, for instance, as I mentioned, instead of stories about distributed systems, or stories about climate change as a matter exclusively for the physical sciences. And we call these narrative deficits and narrative lock-ins that can preclude public examination of a full set of possible systems, models, or futures, and also exclude some collective identities while prioritizing others. So careful story listening can show up the spaces left by absent stories, and it can help balance the forces that can cause some to dominate a particular time and place. I'll hand back to Claire to talk about why all this matters.
So as the former practitioner, half of the partnership, I get the so what. This is part one of the so what. How can this be used practically? A basic story listening exercise would take an existing policy issue and use four functions as a framework to draw out evidence that's available from existing stories. And we're discussing a number of options here, and would welcome ideas in the discussion today. Basically, however, story listening could be used as part of the existing systems in the same way as any other form of academically rigorous evidence. So as the scholar of science and technology studies, Sheila Jasanoff and others point out, that actually means that there isn't one way that doing this kind of evidence gathering and using is very context-based. specific and culturally specific, and the exact mechanisms depend on the policy issue, the framing, the governance, and so on. But to give some examples, as I do here, national academies regularly make reports which draw on multiple disciplines. During the pandemic, it was interesting to see the UK government chief scientific advisor not only having the emergency mechanism SAGE, but also commissioning the British Academy to do some work from the humanities perspective on the long-term implications of COVID. And that's the kind of study that could include story listening. The UK government, like many others, has all sorts of ecosystems of advisors and councils and committees. Any of these could use it. One of the discussions we've had recently was about, perhaps this is a bit of the kind of policy wonk coming back out in me, but the UK government has an aqua book and a magenta book, and one determines the quality of the analysis that is considered to be essential for government, and the other the quality of the evaluation of policy. Both of those set out the kind of standards of rigour that are needed, and you could imagine including different forms of evidence in those. And then there are things like the European Commission's Joint Research Centre, which has done some very interesting work recently, and global structures through to the IPCC and the International Science Council. So those are, that's almost like a kind of whistle-stop tour of various specific mechanisms. More generally, Peter Gluckman, who is former government chief scientific advisor in New Zealand and now the president of the International Science Council, does generalize in terms of evidence gathering in public reasoning in two forms, in sort of two underlying strands, synthesis and brokerage. So on synthesis, this is part of the move away from considering that evidence in public reasoning should be provided by single reports, however eminent, single pieces of research, or by single researchers, towards what reasoning really needs, which is overviews, syntheses of the evidence within a discipline and across disciplines. And indeed, one of the most significant developments in UK provision of synthesis was the Oxford Martin School's own restatements that included studies on things like the evidence on badger culling and radiation. And story listening itself is a form of synthesis and could therefore be incorporated in such work. And then there's brokerage. So all of the mechanisms on the left are partly delivered or informed by the kind of relationships and conversations that regularly go on between decision makers and experts and people who work on the boundaries of academia and of government and do that from within the private sector, within NGOs or within the public sector. And they're involved in an ecosystem in brokerage that means that the quality of the questions that are being asked on both sides, policy and evidence and research creation, get better over time, that people share an understanding of what matters, what might kind of questions might matter in the future, and also better able to communicate with each other because they've spent time learning a little bit about each other's worlds. And in these sorts of areas, it's still the case that by and large the mechanisms and the brokerage practices are stronger in terms of relationship with government in the sciences and in the social sciences than they are in the humanities. So we're back to Sarah to talk about that.
Yeah, so Claire has done the so what from the kind of practitioner perspective. As a scholar of literature and someone very committed and interested in the public humanities, the so what that I'm doing is why this matters for the humanities. So for story listening to put into practice, as Claire's talked about, existing advisory ecosystems and practices don't, we think, need to fundamentally change. They need to expand, become more capacious to include different forms of evidence and knowledge and experts from a wider range of disciplines. And actually what we've encountered is this is not an original claim. People know this needs to happen, and we're hoping that story listening offers a rigorous framework to start helping it happen. What's needed then is perhaps less a change of systems than in some instances a change of minds. And the same might also be said for the adaptations needed in the mindsets of individual humanities academics and scientists and decision makers. And I'm going to take those each in turn to wrap up. So humanities academics, I think, more generally need to think about what narrative evidence might mean in their discipline. So we've developed ours primarily because of my disciplinary expertise out of a kind of literary studies context, but we're very curious to hear how narrative evidence might map onto other humanities disciplines, whether under a different name, and whether a different framework is needed to explain and foreground the types of evidence that different humanities disciplines produce. But we also think that we need to expand on the notion of the kind of lone public intellectual, which has historically dominated humanities sort of self-conceptions, and think about a more pervasive and understanding of the role of the public humanities. And on the previous slide, you may have seen Roger Pilkey's book on The Honest Broker, and we think there's very much a case for mapping his different categories of the way in which a scientist can engage with government onto humanities scholars. So rather than just being pure humanists, or as many are, issue advocates, what would it mean to have humanities arbiters? What would it mean to have humanities honest brokers? And a stumbling block here might be a quite entrenched self-conception of the humanities as reside its value residing on and in its oppositional and critique situation in relation to structures of power, be they state or corporate. Or even universities. One of the arguments we make, again, both and, is that yes, the humanities, in fact, scholarship in general has value as an independent site of opposition and critique, but it also can be a valuable site of knowledge production of use to existing structures and institutions of public reasoning and decision making. And to start to think that to collaborate doesn't necessarily mean to relinquish the capacity to critique. As far as scientists are concerned, for story listening to be effectively integrated, also we think requires an expansion of what is considered to constitute expertise. So scientists frequently appeal to the notion of the scientific method as the basis for the rigor and the distinctive character of their advice, and as the basis on which expert advice can be distinguished from statements based simply on the personal worldviews of the expert. Now, there may be no such simply established thing as the humanities method that might be considered equivalent to the scientific method or the randomized controlled trial. But the guarantees of rigor in the humanities, we don't think are actually that much different as are those from the sciences. And they're also based in the trustworthiness of systems rather than individuals. So things like robust literature reviews, detailed close attention to the object of study using the tools and methods appropriate to that object, discovery of new objects of study, evidence-based conclusions, peer review, disciplinary interrogation, and cumulative knowledge. These are all things that constitute part of the scientific method. And they're all things that constitute part of the humanities method, if we were to call it that. So explaining this might not be as straightforward as in the sciences, but we need to explain it more as humanities scholars and to make the case that therefore it's not irrational to include humanities evidence within pluralistic evidence bases. And to make the case very strongly that methods need to be appropriate to what one is trying to understand. So one would no more use a synchrotron to study a novel than one would use narratology to study an atom. To conclude then, to begin to include narrative evidence systematically as an important first step for decision makers is to develop what we call narrative literacy. A level of narrative literacy that precludes false certainty about stories and understands the need for and value of narrative expertise. So just as a generalist handles a bank account or carries an umbrella, but wouldn't attempt to model future interest rates or global average surface temperatures, so are experts needed who can provide narrative evidence about how stories are functioning and with what effect. And widespread narrative literacy in decision makers, but also in citizens more broadly, in academics and scientists and advisors, means being respectful of stories, but not over-respectful. So knowing that, as Claire has said, alongside their potentially seductive, persuasive, delightful, or harmful emotional effects, it's really important to ask what cognitive and collective value stories might have. And if the public good at stake warrants it, that it's worth seeking and building capacity for narrative evidence in whatever ways you have open to you, wherever you are situated. Because more often than not, a story about a robot is not only always about the robot. Thank you.
Come and sit down. That was brilliant and absolutely fascinating. And it is just wonderful to see, both in your talk and in the book as well, just the genuine dialogue between the humanities and the natural sciences and things, which we all talk about as important, but is genuinely hard to do. So I get the privilege of asking a couple of questions to begin with. Claire, I was going to ask you if you could give a worked example of where you think that narrative listening, story listening, could really be useful in the decision making. And feel free to make it up, but just to give us an example of how you might see it working in practice.
There are several. I think one would be the one that Sarah mentioned, alluded to. If you look at, I'm on the Governance AI Council, you look at all of the massive discussions going on about the governance of AI, you know, massively distributed across sectors, and really quite hard to even begin to conceptualize what's happening now. Then a story listening exercise about the ways in the stories about distributed decision making in, say, the area of impacts on employment would actually bring out potentially new ways of organizing, say, labor in particular areas, or it would bring out ways in which people are already beginning to think about new forms of corporate body, because those sorts of stories are already out there. Some of them are badged as science fiction. Some of them are, in fact, the kind of stories that people are telling in a very anthropological sense, that are just being spoken. Nestor did some rather interesting work generating stories amongst people whose jobs were at threat. So if you pull those out, then what you would get would be some questions and some ideas that you could then look at and say, right, we're thinking about the next stage of governance of the use of AI systems in decision making in the public sector, in crime, say, in predictive crime or in welfare. What kinds of ways, what kind of questions do we need to ask about what those new models might be? You'd have some pictures from the stories that you could set alongside of them.
So at the moment, we'd look at theory, we'd look at our gut instinct and then make policy based on that. But if we actually went out and listened to the narratives that people were telling about each other, we would make better decisions.
Yes.
It's really interesting that you start with that question, though, because the book was published in November last year, and we thought that we were going to have to spend a year or more sort of convincing people of the arguments. And very quickly, actually, the question that we've got repeatedly is, how would this work in practice? So we feel like we've been fast-forwarded pleasantly into thinking about what it actually looks like in practice. And that's why we're trying to do some projects which will be kind of proof of concept to show that, and also why we want to make it happen for real rather than just doing these proof of concept things.
The other area where there's been a lot of discussion of this topic is economics, and you mentioned Robert Shiller's book, and John Kay and Mervyn King have recently written about it, and John Kay actually spoke about it here quite recently. Now, when I read the economics of narrative economics, that strikes me as storytelling rather than story listening. And I have a problem to see how it will be operationalized in economics. Now, I know you're not talking about economics, but do you have any further feeling about how what you're writing, how it engages with narrative economics?
So the Shiller's book in part is, in our terminology, is narratives as data or stories as data. And in a sense, he's talking about using stories as data for models. I think the potentially a more interesting or sort of more distinct area would be in some work, it again comes from science fiction. We don't only talk about science fiction, but it's often the easiest to appeal to immediately. By work edited by William Davis, which is how do you create new, basically new models of organisations, of businesses, that can deal with some of the changes that are happening in markets? So it's about disruptive structures, as opposed to the stories as data, which is something slightly different.
But Shinna does do some story listening, although I wouldn't use that word, in the sense that my memory is this part of the book where he's talking about the way in which a kind of anarcho-international narrative has created a collective identity around Bitcoin. So if you think about the functions, he's thinking about the way in which what we call non-textual narratives. So we differentiate between textual stories, which are kind of embedded and curated, which might align with things like films and novels, and non-textual stories, which might be oral stories that circulate either between human beings in the same room or on social media. And I think Shinna does story listen to non-textual narratives in that book, particularly I think around collective identities, but there's more that could be done, and you could incorporate textual stories as well.
So I'm going to ask a final question, then go to the audience and online. And you made a very interesting point about the different traditions within the social science and humanities about engagement and critique. And that's an issue that we face in the Martin School, where we're quite often policy focused. And some of our colleagues in the humanities and social sciences feel very uncomfortable about actually getting involved in policy on the grounds that it might undermine their independence as a critique. So could you elaborate a bit more on how you see those two different, and I should say equally valid, approaches within the social science and humanities working together? Is it that they remain separate and complementary, or is there a role for them to come together?
Are you okay for me to take that? It's about plurality. So there's no sense in which the argument of the book is that humanities scholars can't be pure humanists and that they can't be issue advocates. And Pilkey very rightly says that issue advocacy is a really important role for academics to play. It's again a both and. It's like, but we're limiting ourselves if we only stay in those two roles as a collective. So it may be that different individuals are comfortable playing different roles. It may be that the same individual is happy to do different roles at different points in their career. But as a kind of collective ecosystem of the humanities, we can expand and we could expand. And I don't think it compromises academic independence. I think it does question some of the narratives that are embedded in the humanities about our value, and maybe that's no bad thing, mm-hmm. actually. And it can really enhance your scholarly work, as I know from having done this kind of collaboration. So it's not to undermine what is already being done, but to say, can we also do more? And in a kind of honest brokerage role, the idea is to just provide the evidence, to provide the best possible synthesis of the available evidence. It's not about saying, and therefore this is the decision that you should make. And actually, I think if more humanists were forced to take that normative element away from their work, it might produce some quite interesting different scholarship as well.
Thank you. Who would like to ask the first question? We have, do we have the microphone? Clara, in the front here. We'll take two questions. Forgive me for pointing at you rudely like this.
Thank you so much, Sarah and Claire. That's really fascinating. My question relates to the marketing of narratives. I think everybody who's tried to publish a book knows you're more likely to get published if something along the lines of this has already been put out into the market and been successful. So for instance, AI narratives, there are quite a few texts about that. Therefore, new texts about that issue become prioritized. Looking at that initial data set, how were you able to account for the commercialization of narratives and therefore that bias?
The question, sorry, I got the bit up until the actual question at the end.
Do you account for the fact that there's a bias in the kind of narratives that get to text stage?
Okay, yeah.
As films, as novels,
The makers of the Matrix trilogy, for instance, talk really interestingly in an interview about film as a high finance art that therefore is dependent on kind of things having already worked, which is why actually so many films are adaptations of novels or short stories that have sold, because you kind of know your narrative is going to work. I think that works, that maps onto sort of popular literary publishing. I think there is still a space in publishing for the radically new. How that links to story listening would be linking in terms of our idea about narrative deficits. So, you know, where do you can't only study dominant or mainstream stories. And this is why we need experts whose job it is to know other stories. So yes, I could talk about Terminator, but I can also talk about the amazing film called Conceiving Ada by Lynn Hershman Leeson, who's an experimental artist, which is a fantastic film about AI, but that is not something that a non-expert would have read. So that would be where it fits, is that the scholar, the expert, can bridge that gap between what makes it onto the dominant market and the stories that are also still out there.
And that is potentially really valuable in several ways. One is that the dominant stories tend to be the ones that in an unexamined ways, even the decision makers think are the dominant ones. So again, I mean, to use the AI example, and I think things have moved on, but sort of 2 or 3 years ago, quite a lot of people were worried about the worries about humanoid robots, yeah? And it was a distracting conversation. And if in fact there'd been some more considered look at stories around AI, including in particular, stories in other languages, all of a sudden you're getting a whole different set of information about possible models of human being and software systems, for example. So it's as you say, looking for the weird stories or the gaps in stories would be part of this process, not just the dominant ones.
Okay, I'm going to ask one from online and then the next one will be here. This is from Jacinta Jackson. Why does the framework exclude the effective nature of stories? We know from behavioral economics that people aren't always rational. The feelings evoked by stories have sometimes been shown to be more powerful than the pure facts within the story.
So I'll stop. This is another both and, right? Stories have, Sarah can speak to the literature on the empathetic, on empathy, but stories have emotional impacts. We're simply saying that may happen. There is also this cognitive value. So we're not, whatever the question was interested in, absolutely fine, of course. But that's often the place that conversations stop at. You know, this story is causing outrage, or this story is, you know, having this effect in this kind of emotional sense. What we're interested in is the quieter voice underneath it that's saying, you know, not just the passion, but what is it about the worldview that's underlying that passion, say? What is the framing? But
yeah, and also really interesting stories cognitively are not always actually very good affectively. So I think as a scholar, you have to make that distinction. There's an amazing short story from the mid-20th century called Deadline, which ended up with the author under house arrest because it anticipated the Manhattan Project before it had become public. And it's an awful story in many ways, but really interestingly, from a cognitive point of view. So there's that point to make. There's also, Claire was laughing about empathy because I wrote a kind of polemic against empathy, which then got revised and moderated and turned into the first chapter, which is that so often the argument for the value of stories is that it helps us empathize and identify, and then we all become better people and we go out and we behave better in the world. There's no evidence that that's the case, either from psychology or I'm not persuaded by the rhetorical cases for this. So there was a real drive from me at the beginning to go, okay, we put empathy aside, which I link with the affective. What other value do stories have that we can build our case on? So that's why the affective is not considered. But we do acknowledge in the book, of course, that often the cognitive value of stories is implicated with their form, which is implicated with their affect, so that they can't always be separated.
Thank you. I should have said that questions from the audience, you might introduce yourself first before asking
me. Hi, my name is Nayana. I'm doing my PhD at the Oxford Internet Institute. And that was so interesting, especially because my PhD is about storytelling. So very relevant. And despite that, I have a question that's going to seem really basic, which is, what actually is a story? And I, you know, you use the word stories a lot, obviously, but what makes you use that instead of the word fiction? How do we kind of, you know, what is a story in your definition of the impact of stories? Is it, you know, the stories that we tell each other, like about our days, or is it published fiction? What is the, what's the kind of impact, and what's the kind of story that you hope will have an impact?
Claire, from the very early on in the book, insisted that we have a glossary, which was entirely an unknown concept to me, and I kind of left Claire in her own Google Doc getting on with it, and I was so grateful. But when we got to the end, that Claire had insisted we have a glossary, because one of the things we did is precisely go through and define those terms, and then literally go through the manuscript and check we were using things consistently. Not least because we discovered, when you work across sectors or across disciplines, that the same word can mean very different things, in very different, or there's different words for the same thing. So the glossary is how we're defining things, not a kind of definitive definition. So in the glossary, the definition of story is, as Claire introduced it, which is a very capacious definition. And now I can't remember it because I haven't memorized it, but it's a causal series of events that has actors in it with agency. And the reason we wanted to keep it that broad was because we wanted to incorporate a scale from this institutional narrative that somebody or, you know, a corporation might print in their, you know, public relations material, through to a film. And this has been one of my frustrations as a literature scholar, is that the skills and the tools of literary studies are so often confined to what we consider our proper object to be. And I think that's a waste of the skills that we have. So to put fiction, as you might call it, on the same continuum as a public narrative was a really important move. We don't use fiction in the book. We purposely avoided using fact and fiction for reasons we may get a question about. So stories and textual and non-textual stories was our lexicon for differentiating.
Great. I'm going to store up a question from the floor and then ask one from, so lady towards the back there. And while the microphone goes to there, I'd like to ask a question from Trish Greenhow. I'm concerned that the framework seems to depict narratives as out there, ready to be collected, heard, imbibed, etc. But surely narrative scholarship in recent years has encouraged us to move on from narrative as noun to narrative as a verb, i.e. place greater focus on the process of storytelling, its context, the audience, and teller-listener dialogue, and storytelling as enactment. Is your framework too static?
Shall I have a crack at it? So I think that because part of the drive was a practitioner one, which was to say, not what could be created in wonderful, perfect settings, but if you've got a problem now, like aspects of climate change, or if you've got a pandemic happening, what is already out there that might actually give you rapidly, or relatively rapidly, some new insights into the framing, the models, etc. So there was a sense of urgency that meant that some of our own framing was about existing stories, and also a sense that there's a waste if you don't look at what's already out there. You know, you've got millennia of human storytelling that you're not looking at. So that was. Having said that, in some of the areas we're also beginning to think about story listening in the context of public dialogue and deliberative democracy, which are some of the interesting areas where thinking about how rigorous evidence gets into public decision making is, you know, so some really interesting thinking there. And in that space, you're quite often both, well, in the perfect world, you'd have your story listening exercise on everything that existed until the moment that you started. And then you'd also be looking at the ways in which people were creating stories as they were engaging between the evidence, including stories and science, and the public policy matter at hand.
Thank you. I've just been told off for clicking my pen, so I apologise to the audience online. The question with...
Thank you. Yeah, I'm Jessie Simkis, so I'm part of the university's policy engagement team, and my job is to help humanities researchers engage with policymakers. So So I have a question, I suppose, about definitions of how you see story listening relating to qualitative evidence, and whether you think that story listening as a concept can feed into or shape discussions about the use of qualitative evidence in policymaking. And also, if I may, a question about practice, and whether you think that there's an issue of time scales, and if you're asking policymakers to imbibe stories as part of their sort of policymaking process, whether it might be quite difficult to condense stories into sort of bullet points, or and whether there might be some resistance to sitting with those stories or hearing them.
I'll take the second one first. I'm not sure how close the mic was to your mouth. So people online, that was the second part of the question was about individual story imbibing by policymakers. That's exactly what we're not arguing for. So Claire's slide where she was talking about ecosystems and structures, this is about recognizing that you have experts who can produce synthesized evidence that can inform decision making. It's not about, and this links to the empathy thing a little bit, getting the Prime Minister to read Jane Austen before he goes into a committee meeting. Like, that's just not what we're claiming or advocating for. And whilst we're advocating for individual narrative literacy, that's not the same as advocating for individual story imbibing of specific stories. So that would take the second point first. And in answering that, I've forgotten what the first question was. Oh, it's a really good question. And it's one that I touched on when I said that we're really interested to hear humanities scholars and social scientists from different disciplines think about what we're calling narrative evidence links to their kind of evidence. And Alex, who's here with us today, we spoke about, has asked that question of us as well. I don't think we have an answer so much as it's something that it's something that links to the bigger question of rigor and what guarantees rigor about the kind of evidence that we're presenting. And so the claims that we'd be making for the rigor of narrative evidence may or may not map onto claims for the rigor of qualitative evidence more generally. Have you got anything to add?
No, I think qualitative evidence is such a broad category. Mm. I'm not really sure what more to say about that, because there's qualitative evidence coming out of the sciences in many ways as well. So.
I did get distracted, Sarah, thinking which character in Jane Austen the Prime Minister would most identify with if he was given the book read. Could we store a question in the front here? And in the meantime, I'm going to go again to Jacinta Jackson. It's not favouritism. Her question has been voted. How does a story listening approach stroke framework deal with the problem of whose stories get told and whose don't?
This is very similar to the question I think that was asked. The answer is it should be a deliberate attempt to listen out for the ones that are not frequently told. And that would be part of the skill of running a specific story listening exercise. In a sense, it's part of the value.
Thank you. The question from the...
Hello, my name's Matilda. I'm an undergrad who does PPE, so I don't have sort of any particular relationship to the topic at hand. I wanted to ask if you'd had the opportunity to apply your concept reflexively, so sort of to the domain of public reasoning, of collecting evidence, what might be the narrative deficits of your approach? And you were saying you're expecting that you'd have to convince people of sort of your approach, but that's actually gone very quickly. What might the particular elements of your approach be that has made it so narratively seductive?
I would say it's not narratively seductive, it's rigorous. do you have a thought?
I think, if I've understood the comment correctly, I think it's partly that there's a real need and hunger. It's so clear that there is knowledge, that we need new forms of rigorous evidence in addition to the ones we've got. I would come to climate change as an example. Having been involved in climate modelling and all the effort that goes into the physical and natural sciences around aspects of climate change, it's superb. But I think the sense that that the next sort of degree of exactitude of certain types of climate model matters less than having some really better, rigorous ways of thinking about the kind of social and cultural connections and interconnections between the physical and the social and cultural. You know, the need is around that kind of hybridization, if you like. So I think the book is partly tapping into that sense of urgency. And if you lay alongside that, the fact that because of discussion about fake news and concerns about and debates around things like the vaccine hesitancy and so on, the sense that there are really powerful stories, if you like, that are operating in ways that people who believe themselves in quotes to be rational, that there's a kind of mismatch between the way we think about other people's stories and what we think of the, what sorry. We try not to use "we" in the book.
We use it when it's literally us.
Just us, yeah. There's a sense of urgency around being able to face up to how stories are operating and to think critically and reflectively about that, rather than just say, "I hate your story. You know, your values are not mine, and I'm not going to listen to them."
The self-referential bit is we do talk briefly in the book about, and I'm particularly interested in this, about textual stories that themselves imagine and model different forms of governments and evidence that informs decision making. So you get into a real recursive sort of loop there. But something like a book we're both hugely fond of, The Three Body Problem by Xi Jinli, is a fascinating narrative model of the limits of scientific evidence to make decisions in the face of uncertainty. So we talk about that book a little bit. And I mean, as a kind of, oh, go ahead.
This is a book about a society facing repeated catastrophes,
yeah.
And having to work out what it can predict about them and how to survive them.
Yeah, and there's kind of different models that are tried out in a game within the story. So there's a little academic project there for me, probably, which would be a kind of to gather those kinds of narratives together and to look at how, in my case, particularly fiction, imagines different forms of governments and evidence.
In here, if you could, I'm going to do one from the web. And forgive me, I'm going to mangle the pronunciation of the name. Jarula Karasadu asks, SDS, which I think is Science and Technology Studies, yep, and more specifically feminist SDS, highlight the relational nature of stories, i.e. how they don't pre-exist but come forth in the act of telling, and how they change according to who is telling but also listening, i.e. a problem is taught differently to a friend, to a doctor, to a researcher. What is the role of the listener in your framework?
Claire's looking thoughtful, so I'll take it. So we don't use the word listener. So story listening is the institutional act of gathering narrative evidence, which could be commissioned by a single person or could be requested by a committee. And we talk about the story imbiber, which would be the individual who's engaging with a story. Listener would confuse in our lexicon those two categories. Mm-hmm. So if the question is about the relationality of the imbiber to a story, then that absolutely matters, for instance, when one is thinking about collective identities. The subjective relationship of the imbiber to the story matters less in story listening, because what you're trying to do is gather a synthesis of evidence from a range of stories. So it's not about the individual's specific relationship to it. The reason why feminist SDS is hugely relevant is that it's historically made a very strong case for needing to value and understand different forms of knowledge, so a kind of history of epistemology. And story listening would fit in an academic sense with that work in, and this is also why we talk at various stages throughout the book about indigenous knowledges, for instance, and needing to recognize both and in addition to the kinds of knowledge and evidence that we value out of science, there are other forms of rigorous knowledge and evidence that have hitherto perhaps been sidelined and we really need actually. And this isn't a kind of ethical case, it's a practical case that we are faced in the 21st century, as we all know, with many urgent, complex, wicked problems as the terminology is, and we need as much and as many different types of evidence to help us make decisions in the face of those.
Claire, anything to add to that?
I think it also brings out the point which hasn't come up here, but is often below the surface, which is some scientists' anxiety about broadening types of evidence in some of the situations that I was showing there. So the fear that, say, by including, it was a mention of indigenous knowledge that brought it up. I mean, there were some really interesting, you know, reflections and work in New Zealand and Canada, for example. Sometimes I think, wrongly, physical sciences and natural sciences lack the confidence in their own, not only in their own sort of science and knowledge, but in the position that they have in some senses fought for and only achieved in the last, you know, few decades, to be in the room with decision makers or to be listened to in an authoritative public setting. And sometimes I think there's an underlying concern that if you kind of open out to other forms of knowledge, that will make it possible for you to be undercut. So the IPCC, with its climate change modelling, we looked at one report specifically, didn't we? It was something like 270 authors, of whom a few were social scientists, but there weren't any humanities scholars. And it's certainly, from some discussions with people involved, it seems that that's partly because of a fear that by loosening the framework and inviting in other forms of knowledge, it would reduce the attributed authority of the science, in that case in climate change, and that would be so devastating and is so frightening that therefore these other forms of knowledge are excluded. And what we're trying to say here is, you know, if it's done right, you get both. And indeed, to not include wider forms of evidence means that the scientific evidence may in the end also be listened to less because it is incomplete.
I've seen this very much in the biodiversity world, where indigenous knowledge has a lot to offer. And it did strike me as you were talking that this might be a way to bring it in a way that everyone can find easier to assimilate. Question there.
I'm Miriam Mendes. I am a research facilitator at the Blavatnik School of Government. My question is related to what you answered before. Is when you use story listening as a methodology in your research, you would have to expand a lot your repertoire of sources. So it's not only literature reviews and all this sort of stuff. You have to use other things. And as you said, there are challenges on that, but there are also maybe beauties in the sense of creating more of an environment for real transdisciplinarity at the level of methodology. How do you think about it?
I'll go. Yes. So it's a question about the need for, and I love that, real transdisciplinarity or interdisciplinarity. There's, I think, become a suspicion of interdisciplinarity because it's been sometimes perceived to be pushed by funders, and it to be this kind of buzzword, and that it's sort of not possible or not real. Absolute fundamental advocate for interdisciplinary or transdisciplinary approaches. I have a paper coming out on that shortly, which models different forms of interdisciplinarity, which can either be a single scholar needing to skill themselves up in different approaches, or, and this is where we talk in the book about more collaboration needed within the humanities and across disciplines. So a single scholar doesn't have to skill up, but you have a range of scholars with existing skills who bring them together. And actually I include in the paper that's coming out, intersectorality, which is a very ugly word, actually as a form of interdisciplinarity, as a form of collaborating with researchers and decision makers who have their own methodologies and own skill sets that academia needs to respect have been developed in relation to their objects of study and the pressures and the needs of their sector. So yes, absolutely, story listening is imbricated. That was the word I kept using, it was very academic, imbricated in the need for and the kind of advocacy for more real interdisciplinarity.
Claire, anything you'd like to add? Look, I'm really sorry. It's past six, so we have to come to an end. I know there are more questions, both from the audience and from online. Just before a couple of thanks, let me point out that this time next week, we're going to be joined by the journalist Oliver Bullough. And many of you will know his book, Butler to the World, How Britain Became the Servant of Tycoons, Tax Dodgers, Kleptocrats, and Criminals. It's a really fascinating book and it's going to be a great discussion. So please do come along. You mentioned several times Roger Pielka. This is looking way ahead, but in November, Roger will be spending a week here and there will be events around with him. Sarah, I hope we can bring you down from Cambridge on full. Splendid.
We clearly missed a trick on our title as well, listening to the title of the book next week, which sounds much more exciting.
For the people in the audience here, please do join us next door for a glass of wine. I should also say that there will be the flyers around, and that gives you a 20% discount on the book. I don't know if that applies to our virtual audience as well, or how we can get that to... There is a code online, so you can get the discount as well. Let me thank the audience for both real and virtual for some really interesting questions. But most of all, you know, it's a really complex topic you've been discussing. You've done it with wonderful clarity. I think this is a groundbreaking book. It's making us think about evidence in a totally new way. And as I said, it's genuine speaking across disciplinary divide. So it really is fascinating. Please join me in thanking Claire and Sarah.